Welcome to the Caroline Gleick Show, where we talk about adventure and activism and how sports can change the world. What are the best practices for creating the changes we want to see in government? On this episode, I talked to Andy Bierman, mayor of Park City, Utah, about his background as a climber, how he got into policy, how trails are built, different models of land conservation, and how everyday citizens can influence their elected officials. You do not want to miss this conversation. All right, I am so excited to be here today with the mayor of Park City, Utah, Andy Bierman. Andy, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today.
Caroline, it's great to see you, and thanks for having me on.
You too. And so it's really cool because I think the first time I met you was when I first started dating Rob, and we would always see you and your wife, Thea, at the climbing gym. And so it's been really awesome to see all your great work on the Park City City Council and then now as mayor. And so I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your background as a climber.
Well, I've been a climber for a long time. Nowadays, I'm relegated mostly to the climbing gym, but I started climbing when I was 17. I grew up in the Midwest, so we used to climb on little limestone cliffs back there and go down to West Virginia to places like Seneca and the New River Gorge. But for me, initially, it was all training to go into the mountains. I dreamed to be a mountaineer and a mountain guide, which I got an opportunity to do several years later. But climbing's been a lifelong passion, and as I sort of stepped away from most of my mountaineering and adventured more at home. I do more cragging nowadays and get to see wonderful folks like you out there.
That's so cool. So what mountains have you climbed?
A lot of them are unknown peaks up in Alaska. I ended up working for the National Outdoor Leadership School, doing mountaineering courses, and we would work in the Alaska Range and the Chugach Range. And a lot of the stuff we climbed in the Chugach was unnamed. We'd just make up names. And I had to laugh. Just last year, I got contacted by a gentleman who was calling me to ask about a first ascent we had in 1991, something I hadn't thought about in a long time. And he was doing a book of all these Chugach climbs, a guidebook going back in time, and he found some old register. So,
That's rad. I knew about you as a rock climber, but I didn't know about your background as an alpinist. And it sounds like you've really been a pioneer in so many different ways.
Well, it was a fun thing to do when I was young, and I miss it every once in a while. I'll go over to the Wind Rivers or the Tetons and do a little climbing. But nowadays, being mayor doesn't allow me to escape very far. I'm more likely to get a few hours to jump on my bike or go climb than get a few days to go to the mountains.
How has that evolution happened from athlete and climber and mountaineer into policy?
Well, no, as a climber, you always, what's the saying? You try to find the most difficult way to the top. And that's a little bit how politics feels sometimes. It's, I actually don't consider myself a politician, being a local elected official. I'm nonpartisan and we do everything on a local level, but it's all a big group project. And I think the time I spent in big group trips and expeditions early on taught me some of the dynamics. And often, if you go on an expedition, you always have the various roles people play. You've got the skeptic and you've got the talented person and you've got the clown. And, I think you look at any council or commission, you end up with the same sort of dynamic. Everybody sort of falls into their roles and you have to learn how to motivate the group.
Wow, that's a really great analogy. And I think that's one of the places where I guess sometimes as a citizen activist, where it can be hard to see like the path forward. And so what tips do you have then for being able to hear and listen to all the voices without losing your own vision?
Well, listening is key. Yeah, you started there and you really do. When you get elected, you represent a community. So it's not about what you want. It's about what the community wants. And if you're lucky, like I've been, at times those have collided and merged. And what's important to me is also important to the community, which makes it really enjoyable to work on. But one thing I like to tell folks, politics is an endurance sport. If you're getting in it to do something quickly, it's not going to happen. When you're in government, whether it's local, state, or federal, you can get big things done. You can get things that are really hard to do as an activist or a business owner or an individual, but it takes a long time. And if you get discouraged, you're unlikely to get it there. You have to stay persistent and continue to build allies and listen and adjust. And also, things never quite turn out exactly how you plan them at the start. It's because there's so many people that are involved in cooking policy, and because the public has a lot of different needs, usually things turn out a little bit different than how you first expected.
Yeah, that's really good advice, and it's a good way of looking at it. So how do you stay positive through it all? Because whenever I see you at these long, the Central Wasatch Commission meetings, for instance, I feel like you always bring a good attitude and a positive energy. And so how do you keep your stoke for it?
Well, I like to think I'm generally stoked to begin with, so that helps. It's just my temperament, but I really do. I still try to find time to get outdoors and rejuvenate and energize, and so I tend to get up really early and go for a long bike ride or run or go climb or skate ski, go backcountry ski, something like that, and that puts a smile on my face and gets the endorphins going and, you know, has me feeling relaxed and ready to get down to work when it's time to sit in meetings. But those long meetings wear you out. They're far more exhausting than being physical.
They are so hard. I know. I had the opportunity last February to testify to the House Natural Resources Committee in Washington, D.C., and it was a three-hour meeting, and I was in the witness stand, and I was sweating so profusely, and I found it to be incredibly stressful, as stressful as a harrowing ski descent down a couloir or a super hard ice lead. And I was I wish I had a standing desk for those things or a treadmill desk, because just being sedentary for that many hours a day, that would be a hard challenge for me, I think, if I was in your seat.
Oh, that's one of the hardest parts of the job for me. And you definitely build a little endurance for it, and it gets easier. And something I tell people, it's always easier when you're up there on the dais and you're actually in the conversations than watching them. It's really hard. I have a lot of respect for folks like you that show up to give testimony and have to wait for hours, because it is hard to stay locked in when you're out there in the audience.
I try. I'm really lucky where I have a great community of people like my partner, Rob, who you know, who come and support me and who are there for the endurance fest as well. And so we keep each other well fed and hydrated and keep each other stoked. And I think that's been a good thing for me as a citizen activist, is to make sure I have a group that I'm able to go in and, you know, to have my posse in activism. But hey, I wanted to go back a little bit, because where in the Midwest are you from? You said you grew up in the Midwest.
Yeah, I grew up in a suburb called Worthington. It's on the north side of Columbus.
Okay, so Ohio.
Yeah, Ohio.
And then how did you make your way out west, and when did you come to Park City?
I think my first trip west was when I was 14. I actually came out, a couple of students came out with a science teacher of ours that drove us cross country and all the way out to Whidbey Island in Washington and Washington State. And when I saw the mountains, I was instantly smitten and said, I'm going to live west. I mean, that it happened in an instant. And since then, I've spent every summer out west, and I sort of in college bounced around between going to school in the Midwest, summers in Alaska, and I also spent some time in Montana. But I took all my courses or all my finals early my senior year, graduated a couple months early, and headed west and never looked back.
So, and then how did you end up specifically in Park City?
So Salt Lake ended up being the airport that most Knowles instructors fly out. So I was working in Washington State, Wyoming, and Alaska. So I spent a lot of time in Salt Lake, and I had some good college friends here, and I enjoyed the climbing here. So I started leaving more and more stuff until I eventually found a job initially in Salt Lake, mostly because I wanted to spend time with a girlfriend. And then I put some roots down there. And after a few years in Salt Lake, I met Charlie Sturgis, who at the time was the owner of the White Pine White Pine Touring, the outdoor store up on Main Street in the Ski Touring Center. And he invited me to come up and manage his shop. And I really didn't know much about Park City at that point. I had really thought Salt Lake was amazing. Coming from the Midwest, I thought it couldn't get any better. And then I moved up to Park City, and I'm like, wow, it gets even better when you live in the mountains.
Yeah. It's a pretty special place for sure. One of the questions I get a lot of times from people, and actually I'm curious about myself, and I don't know if you can answer this, but how do trails get built?
It's complicated, but back in the day, they just got built. A bunch of us would go out and we'd put them in, but that didn't go over great with the property owners. So Nowadays they're negotiated. A lot of our trails are on open space. And so those are usually cleared through the city and county, and we typically cooperate with the mountain trails, and they often build the trails and maintain them for us, but we pay them a fee to do that. Also, when developments go in, there's trail requirements. If there's trails that go through their property and they take those trails out to build, then they have to reroute those and put them back and allow easements for the public to come through. And sometimes as part of the open space they need to donate, we require them to put in trails or trail connections, which end up being huge amenities. And in Park City, having a trailhead that comes to your property is like having a pool or a hot tub. It's a must have.
Yeah. I mean, so is that process specific to Park City, or is that something that's like throughout the U.S.?
That's a great question. And there's kind of a good news, bad news size to Park City, where most mountain communities are surrounded by Forest Service, BLM, or National Park land. So they've got these boundaries. Park City is 100% surrounded by private land. It was all owned by the mine companies or ranchers previously. So that's why we've had to buy so much open space here. We've bought over 10,000 acres of open space. And look around us, any hillside that isn't built on is either land that the city and county have purchased along with our two land trusts, Summit Land Conservancy and Utah Open Lands, or it's land that has been required to be set aside and deed restricted by developers in exchange for, you know, clustering their density. So because that land's in open space held by the city or one of our trusts, it's somewhat easier to build trails on it. And that's part of why we have over 400 miles of trails here, because we can move that through. The process is only a couple of months. Where I hear communities that are building in particular on a Forest Service land, it can take 5 to 10 years to get their approvals to put those trails in.
Whoa, that's mind blowing. Wow, that's super interesting about Park City. I didn't really understand that model of conservation. And so I guess, like, as we look to the future with like these bigger picture conservation goals, like there's this one goal I've heard about in the environmental community where we want to try to preserve like 30% of nature by 2030 and then 50% by 2050. And so do you think that kind of model, like Park City that you were talking about with the deeds and having it be owned by the city, like, is that a better model, or is it better to have it federally protected by the U.S. Forest Service or BLM?
I think it's really situational. And that's a tricky issue that the states and the feds get into it, who owns the land. In our case, because we bought it, we own it. And, you know, the city holds it, but it's really on behalf of the entire community. We hold it. And the land trusts, which oversee it, they actually put a conservation easement on that. And that's in place in case, let's say 20 years from now, our city council politics change. And we decide we like malls more than we like trails and open space. I know, God forbid. But should that happen, then that land trust, we've already put this layer of protection over top, and they actually have a legal protection fund, and they would stop the city with injunctions, and they would sue us, and they would hold us to our own agreements with them. So that's how you keep these lands protected in perpetuity.
Wow, it's really interesting. So yeah. So the city could sell it, but they'd have to maintain the trail easements.
You know, I don't think we can sell. That's a great question. I mean, technically we might be able to sell that land to somebody, but it would come with all the conservation easements and deed restrictions and trails. So I don't know why anybody would want to buy land that they can't do anything on. I think the way some of our bonds are written by which we've purchased this land, we have to maintain it forever, which is good by me. I think this is really our present to the future, all the lands we've protected here. And I think if we could go back in time, we'd try to protect even more, because our quality of life here is based on our natural setting. And if we don't protect it, it'll get built on.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. It's just, that's so interesting. I've just been always curious about going back to, like, you know, the 80s and 90s when a lot of these trails got built, because we have such a fantastic trail network in Park City, and it really, really does improve quality of life, property values, and all of those things.
And we've seen with COVID how behaviors have changed and how much people are recreating outside, and the value of our trails has just grown exponentially and become challenging that there's so many people on them. Despite how vast they are, our trailheads are packed and the trails are busy.
Yeah.
There's been several rec surveys done through the years, and this number always blows my mind. But the most recent survey showed almost 9 out of 10 people that live in our community use the trails on a weekly or more frequent basis.
Wow. That's great.
I mean, I can't think of an activity you have that much buy-in by the entire community, but that's how important they are.
Yeah, yeah. So it's really interesting. But then thinking in the future with growth, like, how do we manage the popularity and also make sure that everyone can have a good experience on the trails?
Yeah, and that's the real challenge. You know, one way you can do it is you can start to charge for parking at trailheads or charge for trail use, but then equity issues come into play. We don't want to make our trails only affordable to those people of means. We want them available to all of our community. I think if you look at what we're trying to do up on Bonanza, we're trying to manage by design, in that we figured out what appropriate carrying capacity is up there, and we put in 4 different trailheads with between them about 200 parking spaces. Mm-hmm. And then we laid out the trail works to spread out people and to remove, you know, some dog trails, some non-dog trails, taking the dogs away from the sensitive wildlife areas. And we've struggled a little because we're still working with our partners at Wasatch County. They're not policing the parking and keeping everybody in the parking lots, so we're exceeding that capacity. But the hope is that you can design to manage that a little bit. The other thing you can do is you can provide rangers or supervisors that help police those sort of things. But what I can say is that the land's worthy of being protected. And when you buy it, you're not done. You need, it's once you own it, it's incumbent upon you to take care of that land and maintain its integrity. And that's a lot more work than most people realize.
Can you give me just a really quick background on how the Bonanza Flats, like, what that situation involved, like, and how it was preserved?
Yeah, that's one I'm really excited about. When I first got on council, I started in 2012, and I told the council that my goal was to protect Bonanza Flat, and they laughed at me. They're like, that'll never happen. And it was owned by Talisker Corporation, who owned most of the land around here. They had bought it from United Parks and Mines, and their plan was to do the world's highest golf community up there. I know. And so they were going to take that beautiful area, put in a golf course, and they were going to put in a bunch of large homes. And then when we saw that they were going bankrupt, we thought there might be an opportunity there. And working with Utah Open Lands, we approached the Wells Fargo, who was taking that land back, and said, we're interested in it. And while we were in the middle of negotiations, a large company called the Discovery Land Co., they own islands in the Bahamas, and they own, they might own the Yellowstone Club or a similar area like that, but they buy these super high-end properties, and they put in exclusive, usually gated resorts, helipads. I mean, you're talking about just for the 1% kind of scenarios. And they wanted to buy it and put in 200 mega homes up there. And so, we were being outbid by them. And what we said is we'd like to put in a backup offer in case these things fall through. Because what we've learned over time is, you know, the city is, we may not be able to pay top dollar, but we're stable. We're always there. And if we say we can do something, we do. And so we actually ran a bond on a backup offer, which was a little bit hard to explain to the public that we're not sure we can buy it, but the only chance we'll have is if we have the money when we need it. And the bond passed, and Discovery Land Co. stumbled a little bit, couldn't come up with the funding, and Wells Fargo came back and said, here's your window. If you're ready to roll, buy it. And we did. So
I just got goosebumps as you told that story, because the Bonanza Flats is this area in between Park City and Big Cottonwood Canyon. And it's just, I think it's home to one of the largest aspen forests in the world. Maybe I'm wrong with that. I need to fact check myself there, but it is stunning with just amazing views from Heber to the Wasatch Front. And that new trail system now, I have loved running that this summer. It is incredible. And the way that you've developed the parking and everything, it's so special. It's such a gift and a legacy. And so congrats on having that vision and seeing it through despite the naysayers telling you that it couldn't be done.
Yeah, that one, I'll tell you, when I look back on the time I served and the things I'm excited about, that's probably going to be at the top of the list always. I mean, that's such a special place. And what people don't know is we initially bought 1,400 acres and we've picked up about another 250 through land swaps and small purchases and an agreement with the Girl Scout camp up there. So it's become, it is really one of the gems of the Wasatch, being our high meadow up there with wonderful wildlife and lakes and wildflowers. And I've heard the same rumor that that's home to one of our largest aspen groves. So it's an area I think that not just Park City, but the entire region treasures. And I'm just so grateful it doesn't have 200 big homes, a golf course, and walls.
I know, and helicopters going in and out. And I know that's a really wonderful legacy for future generations. And that new trail going up to Bloods Lake, it's beautiful trail. Who built that?
Mountain Trails did.
Wow.
So we put aside some money when we bought it to do some trail work. Utah Open Lands, who holds the conservation easement, and they deserve a lot of credit for this. They did a lot of fundraising on top of the money that the city came up with. They got a lot of grants for trails up there. And then we had a local family contribute for almost the whole cost of the Blood Lake Trail. They have a plaque up at the start of that. But a lot of folks have gone into that, and there's, I think, three or four new trails that are just opening this month up there.
Oh, so cool. I'll have to go run them. Yeah, I'm really into Strava right now, and there's this like new thing where you can get the local legend badge if you do the segment the most times. So I'll have to go and collect some of those up there.
Okay, well, if I see somebody dust by me, I'll know who it is.
Oh, I don't know about that. I'm not the fastest runner. I just like to get out every day. So do you think that this model with Bonanza Flats is something that people in other communities could replicate?
I think it is. And I spend a lot of time down in Moab. I have a second home down there, and it's kind of my second love. When I want to escape Park City, I go down, and I know their elected officials really well. And I've been encouraging them down there. They're surrounded by so much federal land. They don't even think about buying land, but they've got some really what I would call, I just call them atrocious. That's probably not politically correct, but they've got some projects going in that are just really going to have big impacts on wonderful areas. And I keep telling them, some of this stuff you need to protect yourself. You can't just count on the federal lands, that there are key locations that you can buy up and turn into a bike park or just preserve altogether. Wildlife preserves do various things. And a lot of other communities have looked to our model here. Certainly, we borrowed this from Aspen. I think they were the first ones buying land and preserving it. And years ago, Park City went out there on a city tour and saw what they were doing and came back with that idea. So it's not unknown, but when you hear a lot of communities complaining about growth and it being out of their hands, out of their control, they might be surprised if they go to their citizens and say, would you be willing to pay just a little more taxes to protect that land, to protect your quality of life, and to have new opportunities for trails and recreation? Because here it's been overwhelming. Both Bonanza and Treasure, our last two bonds, I think Bonanza passed at about 70%. And Treasure passed by 79%, which it's really hard to get that kind of buy-in on anything in a community.
Yeah, well, I feel like outdoor recreation in general is just one of those things that really brings people together. And I really believe in these initiatives that are happening now to increase access and equity in the access to the outdoors, because it's just like for our mental health and our physical well-being, for all these things, it's so important to have access to trails.
I agree with you. And I think circling back to, you talked about there's a push to preserve a certain amount of wilderness around us nationwide or maybe worldwide. And I think as we look forward to what society is going to look like, the more of that we can plan for today, the better. I mean, there's a lot of undeveloped areas that can learn from the mistakes we've made in terms of, as a culture, how much we've sprawled as opposed to densify and preserve those wild places for us to go find ourselves or get lost in, whichever you prefer.
Yeah, right. So I was curious, what are other tips you have for everyday citizens who love the outdoors to get involved with their local government on things that matter, whether it's preservation and conservation, or whether it's climate and renewable energy, or whether it's following up from the BLM, the Black Lives Matter movement, for all those things? Like, what would you advise people to do?
Well, for starters, I'd say get involved, because you will make the difference. All the great things I've seen happen in Park City over my years don't come from elected officials. It comes from the public. It comes from our activists really pushing good ideas forward and putting pressure on the elected officials. And every once in a while, you're lucky to have elected officials that know how to move things, you know how to take that public energy and turn it into action. But without that public energy, it's not going to happen. I look at our critical priorities in Park City. We have four of them: transportation, housing, energy, which is climate, and equity. And every one of those have come out of the public coming to council and saying, these are areas we want you to focus on. We want you to prioritize, and this is what's important to us as a community. And that gives elected officials and city staff or county or state, whatever level, the courage to move forward on these actions. So being an activist is the most powerful role out there.
Okay, so you're mayor. What is the best way that you like to be contacted? Like, do you like it when people tweet at you, email? Like, what? How's as an elected official yourself, what is the best way for people to get in touch?
Well, my favorite is actually going out and seeing people. Like, that's the one part that's really fun about campaigning, is going door to door and seeing people in their neighborhoods and being invited into their houses and hearing about their issues, meeting their kids. That's always the most personal way. It's not the most efficient way. Email has become a tool where people will reach out to you. And I recommend, if you reach out to an elected official, personalize it. There's nothing that drives us more crazy than getting 40 of the same email at the same time. And you just don't, it doesn't mean as much to you. It doesn't mean we ignore it. It just doesn't have the same impact as somebody sending you a personalized email why a particular issue is important to them. Phone calls, texts, tweets, it's all fair game. I'm not very good with tweets and Facebook messaging, you know, in terms of if somebody wants to get me something right away, I don't check those as often.
Yeah. What about handwritten letters? Is that a good idea?
if you can read them, they're great.
Right. Okay. Do you, open up mail from your constituents, or?
I don't get a lot. It's funny. I would have to say most of the mail I get are either thank yous that, you know, from an organization that we've helped or something, or it's somebody that's mad about something.
Right.
I had to laugh. I'm trying to think what the issue was this winter, but it had to do with, some of the early bubblings up of the social unrest and police. People were sending me Christmas cards that were actually hate mail. There was like a letter in there tucked in the Christmas card. And sometimes people get clever when they want to send you nasty notes.
How do you deal with that kind of negativity?
You build tough skin. The longer you serve in the office, you kind of get used to it. I will admit, with COVID and the sort of weariness of this going on for as long as it has, and the rising anxieties, and you throw the economic change, you have a health crisis and the economic crisis, you've got social unrest, which is turning into a crisis. You add all that up, and I would say civility is going out the window right now. So I've never been so challenged by the communications I'm receiving. I mean, I'll get up in the morning and sometimes, oh, what a wonderful day. And I'll open my email and I'm like, oh my God, people have just kind of lost their sense of proportion.
It's really sad. I had a similar thing happen to me the other day. I was about to go to bed and I got some random message from some woman on Instagram. And it wasn't even about any political thing. She was like, you should get Botox in your forehead. And I was like, why would you say that to me? Like, that is just so weird. And I've gotten much better at not letting it get to me. But when people send you the negativity, does it influence your policy making, or does the negative stuff have an impact on how you respond from a policy standpoint? Or are you more motivated when people, like, if I was dissatisfied with your decisions as your constituent, what is the most effective way for me to to communicate my dissatisfaction to you.
Well, a good elected official listens to both. You got to give it equal time. And if people let you know when they like something and want to see you do something, they'll let you know if they dislike something. To me, I think the best input, whether it's good or bad, is topical. People, it's more powerful if you take time to educate yourself on the issues. And so you can rather than say, I just plain dislike something, say, I dislike it for X, Y, and Z reason, and have you considered these alternatives? Something like that to me is a really powerful form of feedback that I'll take a lot of time and consider it. If somebody just says, I just don't like it, that's hard to deal with at some point when, you know, you don't really know why they don't like it, if they want you to adjust it, or they just don't like the idea altogether. So, you know, there's a degree of activism that I think you just want to get people's attention and make them aware that something, you know, needs to slow down or it needs to be reconsidered. But if you really want to get in the nuts and bolts and help set policy, you need to educate yourself on the issues. You need to develop some empathy for the people that are asking for something and figure out why they think there's a need and why those elected officials are trying to push it forward. And then you can be constructive.
Yeah, empathy. That's something we're really missing, I think, right now, and something we could all practice a little bit more is listening and having empathy for each other.
It's true. Although, you know, I will say, I don't want to say that people are just being negative right now, because I'm actually seeing them on both sides of the spectrum. I'm seeing more empathy and more caring out of some people, and then sort of more frustration out of others. And I think that's, you know, having never been through a crisis like we're seeing right now, it just seems like it pushes people to the extremes in either direction. And so you have to be really considerate of that too, but it requires you to sort of adjust your skin thickness as well. Sometimes you need to be more caring and more empathetic, and other times you just need to have your armor on because you're going to get beat up.
Well, how do you know then which one to do when?
Trial and error.
Yeah, I guess that's a tough one. Well, I wanted to go back to one of the first times that I ever interacted with you as an elected official, which was at a Park City Council hearing. I think it was 2015 or 2016. I can't remember when you decided. Which year was it?
I think it was 2015.
Park City decided to go 100% renewable by 2030 at that meeting. And there was like a really small group of us. I think there were maybe like 30 people in the room and maybe 10 or 15 people who spoke from the ski and outdoor recreation community. And we were really pushing Park City to establish themselves as a leader in the mountain community and to go on this most aggressive, because I think you had three different initiatives for your renewable energy goal at that time. And so we were like, do it big, go big, do it now. And so at the end of the meeting, I think there was just one or two council people who decided against it, but the vast majority were in favor, right?
I think in the end, it was unanimous. It started out, I can tell you, before the public got involved, and I called your little posse, and it wasn't so little. I mean, I think it was upwards of 60 people, but not all there at the same time. But I called you all our carbon army, that a group of activists that came in. And when it started, I mean, there were only two council members that were in favor of aggressive goals, myself and one other like that. But your particular group came in meeting after meeting and made the case for it and showed the support for it. And the beauty is it wasn't just one meeting or two meetings. This happened over 4 or 5 months, and the emails kept coming, the letters kept coming, the personal appearances kept coming, the pressure was there, and the case was made really well. And eventually all of council said, yeah, this makes sense. You brought us around. And I just thought that was a wonderful example of coordinated activism. And I talked about politics being an endurance sport. The endurance was there. It wasn't just like, hey, let's flood the room, yell at them, and hope they make the right decision. It was, we're going to keep the pressure on because we know this is the right thing to do and it needs to be done now.
Well, as an activist for, like, I've been working on climate and I've been working on clean air. And I lived in Salt Lake up until a few years ago, and then I moved up here, and I've been working on those things for so long. And I have to say that that's one of the things that I helped in a small way with a group of a ton of other people. And I feel like that's one of the things I'm most proud of in my career as an activist, because whereas we worked with like the Obama campaign to try to get the clean energy plan passed, and then the new administration just like cut that, like all the, and then bear's ears, neck got axed. And so I feel like that's the one thing that I've lended my voice to that's actually stuck. And it's going to transform our grid in the state of Utah. And I wanted to check in with you to see 5 years later how we're doing and how we're getting to those goals and how can we take what we've learned from that and hopefully, you know, how could people do that in their, with their city?
No, thanks. Thanks for asking that question, because when we set that goal, we understood that Park City as a community is not even a drop in the bucket on a global scale. So we could go net zero and it isn't really going to help the planet per se. So part of what we wanted to do was not only do it locally, but use ourselves as a proof of concept and create momentum for this idea so other communities could learn from it and imitate it. And we even looked at how we can make this replicable. So that was our initial goal. Formed around 5 years ago when we set the net zero by 2030 in place, which was the most aggressive goal by a city in North America at the time.
So cool.
And now we're actually seeing a lot of that come true on two fronts. To go net zero, we have had to partner with other Utah cities and counties to get there. And so there are a lot of changes that have to be made to our energy grid. So working with Rocky Mountain Power, working with Salt Lake City, Salt Lake County, Summit County, we were able to get legislation passed, bipartisan support for legislation that allows many of Utah's cities and towns to convert to renewable energy. And we weren't sure how much buy-in we were going to get. The first part was getting the legislation through, which we did, which is pretty amazing considering, you know, the state rock is coal. Mm-hmm. We're about as red as you get. And, you know, I had some lobbyists afterwards tell me, they're like, do you realize that in Utah, you passed the most progressive legislation in the nation on this? And we said, yeah, because it was common sense. It wasn't partisan. It's what was good for future generations. It's good for our environment and it's better for the consumers. So long and short, we're still negotiating the finer points, but we're just getting ready to start building our first giant solar utility. And we have 24, I believe, either 23 or 24 cities and counties in Utah that have signed on to this net zero plan by 2030. And that will represent about 60%+ of Utah's entire electric use.
Wow.
So here, this little goal of Park Cities, you know, pursuing it, we've had to change statewide legislation, which has opened the door and made the argument for many, many communities to jump in on. And so, you know, that's something I'm super excited about. But to take it in yet another direction, we formed a group, and this wasn't city driven, although a few of us from the city were involved, but we founded a group called Mountain Towns 2030. And the idea there was to share the work we're doing here and create enthusiasm and gather new ideas from other mountain communities. So we hosted a summit in Park City last year. We were very fortunate. We got Paul Hawken, who is the guru on carbon and energy, and Jane Goodall to come to be our keynote speakers. And we had a wonderful couple of days, but what came out of that is we have communities all over the Mountain West that have gone home. I think at least 5 or 6 of them have set 2030 goals matching ours. At least that many are preparing to do so and sort of got held up by COVID, but I believe coming out through the recovery, they'll do it. And we've got several other communities, both in Colorado and Montana, copying our energy plan with the legislature and trying to do similar legislation at home so they can help convert their energy grid to 100% renewable. So it's working.
It's so cool. I'm so fired up about that. So how can we continue to support your leadership with that?
Wow. Good question. I would say keep the stoke.
Yeah.
We're really trying to influence the whole outdoor industry and the ski sports industry to jump on board. I think you look at our ski resorts in particular, they're so integral to mountain communities like ours. It's hard to separate where the resorts start and the cities or the counties or the communities end. We're all tied together. So we've made them part of the discussion and we've gotten some pretty good commitments from them on energy and 100%. And so I would say consumer pressure, activism pressure to get them on board will help. The outdoor industry has always been an ally, but I think a better coordination there in terms of you've got all kinds of companies doing great things, but I'm not sure those ideas are being shared as well as they can, nor do I think those companies are really using their political power and their economic power and their know-how to influence their surrounding communities. And the more that can be done, we can generate, we have a movement building at this point, and it's gaining public support. So the more we can bring it from the mountains to the cities, the better off we're going to be.
Wow. It makes me so proud to be a Park City resident. We have the coolest mayor with Mayor Andy Bierman. And so I'm really hyped on all the things you're doing. And one of the things with the climate movement we've been talking about a lot lately and is, you know, how taking this kind of action on climate, it helps the people who are most affected by the pollution from coal power plants, like mostly people who live in communities of color. And so I wanted to bring this back to talking about Black Lives Matter. One of the other cool things I think you've done as a mayor is you helped, I saw your panel discussion you did with the mural artists. You commissioned a few artists, four groups of artists,
yep,
to do these
four groups of artists,
beautiful murals on Main Street. And I was really excited about that. But I wanted to see, like, living in Park City, the whole Black Lives Matter movement has really, I mean, I knew that Utah's really white, but the difference between, like, how white it is in Park City versus, like, Salt Lake and West Valley, what are we doing now to help decrease the barrier of entry for housing in Park City? Like, how can we diversify our community here and see more Black people who live here? Because I think I only know one Black person who lives in Park City, and that made me really sad.
It really is sad. I mean, the whole state lacks diversity, and I'm going to start answering your question on a broader level, if that's okay, and I'll work back to housing. But, you know, one of the things I've realized in my current role, so I've been a lifelong environmentalist and activist, and I've always been an ally on social issues, but they haven't been my jam. They haven't been my passion, or you can only stand for so many things. But as mayor, you learn you got to stand for everything. And not everything, but there's a lot of pressures in the community. But what you quickly realize is how intertwined all these issues are. And I've been looking at this issue of communal health and an individual health and environmental health, and they're all tied together. Mm-hmm. And you see something like that. Like, you see when a pandemic like COVID hits, that we are only as strong as the community as our most vulnerable. It brings that home. You realize there are people in the community that this is just devastating to. And that's what scares me so much about climate change. I think climate change is going to be a much more prolonged, much more devastating version of what we're seeing out of what's essentially a super flu. You know, we're getting a little preview of the chaos that could happen in 10 or 20 years. And one of the things we're seeing is our underserved communities, which are typically our communities of color, and our immigrant communities, are getting hammered the worst out of anybody, because they're on the frontline jobs, the service workers, they live in more dense situations, they don't have as good access to healthcare. And so, you know, the essential understructure of our community is in peril right now. And they're feeling the economic hits the hardest. So I think even though Park City, we live in a bit of a paradise and we don't see all the urban challenges we still are impacted by our challenges with diversity and how we can better integrate and give a hand up to our service workers. In our case, it's mostly our Latinx community, which is somewhere between 25 and 30% of our community. And many of them are citizens, but many of those families also have members here that are out of status, which creates a whole nother challenge. You also see us lack just general diversity here. We have very few people of color outside of our Latinx community and a small Filipino community. And that's something that we're just doing some examination right now. Why is that? And I've had I've talked to some folks and gotten some feedback, and they've given us some great advice that we need to make ourselves a more welcoming place, that we need to send a message that despite the fact we're in Utah, that kind of has a reputation as being very homogenous homogenous and maybe not the most accepting area, that we are an accepting community and that we want diversity here. And, you know, that means figuring out ways to get your diversity involved in your power structure so they have a greater voice, maybe even an oversized voice compared to their percentage of the population, because they're going to help you create a better environment and help us work through our blind sides and our racial biases and our systemic biases, things which I think as a community we want to move past, but sometimes we don't even realize when and where they exist. So the short answer is I think it's going to be a generational challenge of creating a welcoming and inclusive community, and hopefully that will draw more people of diversity. But we're really going to have to look at our systems and figure out ways to fast track this by involving more people of diversity in our power structure and creating equal access for everybody that's here.
Yeah, yeah. No, I really appreciate you spoke so eloquently about that. And it's a tough question, and it's something I think we're all asking ourselves right now, or at least a lot of people that I know are, we're having these like deep inner dialogues. And I just wanted to go back to see how you think housing plays into that, because it's my, you know, Rob, my husband, he's a realtor. And right now the real estate market in Park City is going bonkers. Like if you are a first time home buyer, you're looking a million plus just to get into a single family, a decent single family home. And so do you think like more affordable housing is the answer, or like what are your ideas on that?
Housing is always a tricky one because we moved to the mountains to live in a small town community and not deal with sprawl. So by the nature of the community, there's a degree of elitism. It can't accommodate everybody. What I do think we can do is we can plan better. We can build in our core of town a little bit more dense than we are. Doesn't mean we have to do high rises or projects, but we can increase our density a little bit. We can be more thoughtful about our transportation network, so people that live in surrounding communities can feel more part of this community and have good transit connections, whether it's active transit through trails or actually, you know, using our electric buses to move people around. But the city also has a fairly ambitious housing goal of by 2026, we'd like to build 700 new units. We've got about 200 of those built. We have a plan for another 200 or 250. And then after that, it gets a little tricky. We haven't quite figured out how we're going to bridge that remaining gap. And those are units that are mostly for young families is what we're targeting, because we feel like that's the group that's having the most trouble getting into town. But we're also working on rental properties for service workers. It's very difficult to come here and be somebody that works in a restaurant or works at the resorts or teaches skiing. So we're concerned at this point because we feel like we're losing a lot of our middle class. We're losing the next generation. Folks like you and Rob are going to be the ones that need to step up and be, you know, on the boards of the next nonprofits, be on the city councils or county councils. You know, at some point you got to get involved in your community on that way. And if we don't make a ladder, it won't happen. We won't have new blood and new energy. We'll stagnate as a community. And to us, we've really always valued our vibrancy and the multi-generations we have in town. And even though we don't have great ethnic diversity, at least we've got good, we have people from all over the world and of different ages and some intrigue there. And we have to preserve that. And we have to keep a middle class in town. And that's really, really hard with today's economics. And as Rob's been telling you, real estate is crazy because nobody wants to live in the cities anymore. They want to live up here.
No, it's wild. And what you just said about making sure that, you know, first-time homebuyers and families and seasonal workers and all those people, like, we really want to make sure people can live the ski bum dream, you know, as we knew it. And that it's a dream that is inclusive of people from all different racial backgrounds and all different walks of life. So I really appreciate you taking on that question. And yeah, I'd love for you to let me know how it can keep supporting you with that work forward, because that is probably like one of the most difficult challenges we have ahead.
Well, I think COVID has given us some insight to what our future could look like. I talked about that a little bit earlier, that, you know, pandemics are one of those existential threats that everybody's been talking about for 50 years, that someday this is going to happen. And it's very similar to climate change in that way. It's always one of those someday threats where you can put it on the back burner because it and not maybe prepare for it as well as you can. we've gotten a glimpse into how something small, right? And I don't want to understate the pandemic, but it's not nearly as bad as it could have been. It could have been much more contagious. It could have been much more deadly. You know, we'll see how long it persists, but it seems like something we'll be able to move past as a society. Climate change isn't going to be so easy to move past. Once those global temperatures change, it is going to take generations to recover from that. So as we come out of this pandemic and we build resilience, I think we can be building the very same resilience we need to address climate. We can retool our economy. We can retool how we approach things. We can start preparing for these threats that we know are real. We just don't know when they're going to hit. And I think the planetary pause we have taken by sheltering in place and consuming less and using less energy, a lot of people got used to that and said, that isn't so bad. There are a lot of things we like about this. And I think now's our opportunity to build and reimagine society going forward, reimagine how we do things, reimagine how we use our energy and build a better world.
Yeah, no, that's such a great way to end, because this whole conversation really illustrates how important it is for people to vote for the local elections as much as the national ticket items. Because like having people like you steering this ship like on the local level is creating this much longer lasting change than we see at the federal level. And so I really want to encourage people to be engaged in their local elections and support their local newspapers too, so that they can get accurate information about these kinds of issues. Like the Park Record did such a great job covering everything that was happening with Bonanza Flats and with the local backyard issues. Like we have to stay as engaged with those as we do on the national items. So Andy, you've been awesome to chat with today. And yeah, I just wanted to see if there's anything else you wanted to add.
I just want to thank you for all the good work you've been doing. I mean, you were pivotal. You and the Carbon Army were pivotal on moving this community forward. And I hope you're proud of the ripples it's had out to other communities. And at Outdoor this winter, I take a walk and I see you leading the climate march down the street and generating enthusiasm and activism. And we're going to need that fall. As you said, voting is important, and who you vote for really matters. And we have a big election coming up, not just some local ones, but certainly on a federal level. And so I hope you keep working your magic and keeping people stoked, and let's keep working towards a better world.
Yeah, let's keep the conversation going. I'd love to talk to you again in a couple months for how people can run for local office, because that's definitely something on the radar in the future. So we'll have to do this again. Andy, Mayor Andy Bierman, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks again. Have a great day.
You too.
I am resilient. I trust the movement. I negate the chaos. Uplift the negative. I'll show up at the table again and again and again. I'll close my mouth and learn to listen.
Special thanks to Avery Sandak for his help with the audio on today's episode. To my partner, Rob Lee, for being extra quiet while I'm recording in the house today, and to Rising Appalachia for graciously providing the music for today's episode. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend and rate and review it so other people can find it. Until next time.